down, and we're in business. Okay, so tonight we'll begin a new season of Jewish history. So for those from the Woodmere group, this is our 10th season together, actually. Shalom Krat will be our 9th season together studying Jewish history. And our topic will be American Jewish history. And I hope to cover from the beginnings all the way to almost contemporary times over the span of the next maybe 11 months. So tonight's topic, I labeled it periodization and Peter Stuyvesant. We're going to discuss the periodization of American Jewish history, and then we'll discuss the opening salvo, the beginnings in New Amsterdam with Peter Stuyvesant. So the conventional periodization of American history follows a well-known path for those who've studied the topic. You have the colonial period, you have the revolution, the establishment of the republic, Jacksonian democracy, manifest destiny, controversies over slavery, the Civil War, Reconstruction, and so on and so forth. There are certain key landmarks in the study of American history, and all the courses in high school and college and graduate school follow that pattern. So the question is whether or not American Jewish history can follow the same periodization as general American history. And the answer is no, it can't. Because while certainly the average individual Jew was affected in America by the larger patterns that affected the broader society, the Jews as a collective, as a community, were largely influenced by factors that are specific to the Jewish people and not the broader issues involving American society. American Jewish history is the least Jewish of all the topics in Judaic studies. And when I say it's the least Jewish, it means that you can't be a complete Am Haaretz, a complete ignorant fool, and get a PhD in other areas of Judaic studies. You have to know Hebrew, Aramaic, rabbinic literature, the Talmud, the Bible. You have to know a lot of stuff. American Jewish history is different in that it stands alone. You just have to speak English, and maybe you have to know a little Yiddish or maybe a little German. But you don't have to know the rest of the Jewish experience of thousands of years. You can simply know what happened the last 350 years in this country, and there you're an expert in American Jewish history. And so the scholarship on American Jewish history is in a realm by itself. It's not in the realm of all the others of Mada'i Yahadut. Okay. Nonetheless, the periodization of American Jewish history is specific to our people's experience, and it follows certain key criteria. And those are arrival, acculturation, and communal building. Arrival, acculturation, and communal building. That we're going to divide up this 350-year period based upon when waves of Jews came from other places, okay, and they certainly came in waves, their acculturation, how they came to fit in and adopt an American lifestyle rather than that of the immigrant. And lastly, communal building, what kind of institutions are they going to develop for this society, for this Jewish community? That will be able to break down each period in time. This is different. This is noticeably different from the periodization and historiography of other great Jewish communities of the past, of the last several thousand years. Because other great Jewish communities, you divided it up based upon major events in the religious history of our people. In other words, the destruction of the first temple, the destruction of the second temple, the codification of the Mishnah, the codification of the Talmud, the division between the period of the Rishonim and the Acharonim. Usually some great rabbinic work, some canonical work is sealed, and we move from one period of time to the next period of time. Or another thing that can divide the various epochs of Jewish history is when a community is destroyed by anti-Semitism. In other words, you're wiped out, gone, expelled, and that ends the golden age of this community or the golden age of that community. So suffering, destruction, that's one type, or religious development and canonization of literature, another type, are typically how we define the periods in Jewish history. This is what Salo Baron referred to as the lachrymose conception of Jewish history. The lachrymose conception means that what the Jews do for thousands of years, they learn and daven on the one hand, and they suffer and die on the other, and they don't do anything else. You learn and daven, and you suffer and die. That's Jewish history. So for many writers, especially for Heinrich Gretz in the 19th century, who was the great leading figure in early Wissenschaft, that's what Jewish history writing was all about. Baron in 20th century America at Columbia University wanted to change all that. And see, he said, no, Jews are real people. We do things other than learn and daven and die. We engage in commerce. Okay, we have culture. We have arts. We interact politically with others. We are like everybody else, except we, you know, put on tefillin in the morning. So that, with that in mind, the periodization of American Jewish history will reflect things other than learning, davening, dying, and suffering. All right. Okay. So what is the consensus about periodization? So the great Jewish historian, American Jewish historian, Jacob Rader Marcus, was the professor at Hebrew Union College in Cincinnati for like a million years. He died at the age of 103 in, I think, 1998. And he was the leading figure in the field for a long, long time. And in the late 1950s, he wrote an article in which he divided up American Jewish history into four epochs. And I'm not going to agree with everything he wrote, but I want to give it to you because in the study of the topic, this is considered a groundbreaking article. So he says there are four periods: the Sephardic, the German, the Eastern European, and the American periods. So Sephardic, German, Eastern European, and American. The first one he labels the rise and decline of Sephardic Jewry, 1654 to 1840. So rise and decline of Sephardic Jewry. He subdivides that into the colonial period, which is 1654 until 1776, the revolution, and then the early national period, 1776 to 1840. He further subdivides the colonial period into the Dutch period of 1654 to 1664, and then the British period, the English period, from 1664 until 1776. Why is this called the Sephardic period? The answer is because the Spanish-Portuguese community, or rather the Spanish-Portuguese element of the Jewish community, was dominant. They weren't necessarily demographically the majority all throughout. In fact, the Spanish-Portuguese Jews really were only the demographic majority of American Jewry from the beginning in 1654 until about the 1720s, at which point in time the Polish and the German Jews, the Ashkenazim, outnumbered them. But even though they outnumbered the Sephardim were the economic and social elite, and they ran the synagogues, so therefore the culture of American Jewish life was that of a Sephardic culture in which the minutes of the synagogues were a board meeting were written in Portuguese. Even though nobody spoke Portuguese, they spoke English, so for old time's sake, they kept it in Portuguese. And the Nusach HaTefillah, the liturgy, the rite in the synagogue, was the old Spanish Portuguese rite, and not that of Central or Eastern Europe. Okay, so another factor is that the economic pattern of the Jewish people in the colonial period was that of merchant shippers. These were Jews who were engaged in mercantilism, in international commerce, not petty trading on a more local level. That would happen later on in the German period. So the Sephardic period, as I mentioned, it has its Dutch section and its British section. It changes with the Revolutionary War in the sense that Jews now have rights under the American regime, under the federal government. As for state governments, we'll talk about that at length over the next few weeks. State governments begin to give Jews full rights in 1777 in New York State. But the last state doesn't give full rights to Jews in New Hampshire until 1877, 100 years later, when they get rid of the last religious disability test. Okay, but the Sephardic community doesn't last forever. The Sephardim suffer atrophy, intermarriage, religious indifference, and general decline, including decline in their economic profile. And so, as the early Republican period moves on, they eventually cough up the leadership of the community and hand it over to the Germans. With 1840 being considered a turning point as far as Rader Marcus was concerned, because in 1840, that's when religious reform is developed in Charleston, and Isaac Leeser, the leader of a Philadelphia Jewish community, began his efforts to organize the Jews into a national organization of synagogues. So German Jews are taking the lead on religious and communal matters. And so the Sephardim have lost their power, their influence, and they're gone. Now, that's not to say that they're gone completely. After all, Sheretz Israel, the first ever synagogue, is still around today. And Rabbi Meir Soloveitchik would vigorously protest if I said they're irrelevant. No, they still exist. I have a big shul on 70th Street in Central Park West. But it means in terms of communal leadership of American Jewish life, the Sephardim no longer were dominant. Okay. The German period, the second period. According to this approach, it lasts from 1840 to 1920. And it's called the rise and dominance of the German Jew and the challenge to his leadership. So German Jews establish significant communal institutions, including B'nai B'rith, Union of American Hebrew Congregations, Board of Deputies of American Israelites, all sorts of things that you could think of. The ABC alphabet soup organizations, that are, some of them are still around today, are established by the German Jews in an attempt to exert communal leadership. But the challenge to their dominance is from the fact that Eastern European Jews are already coming to America in significant numbers by the middle of the 19th century, and especially after 1881. And so by 1919, there is a more democratic form of American Jewish leadership, notably in the American Jewish Congress, as opposed to the American Jewish Committee. The American Jewish Committee was not democratically elected. It was a rich, extremely wealthy German reform assimilated Jews who threw their weight around protecting Jewish interests in this country. Established in 1906, and it continues to this very day, American Jewish Committee. However, because it was non-democratic and was for our crowd, for the wealthy elite, that didn't go over well with the Jewish masses who were of Eastern European extraction. And they established the American Jewish Congress under the leadership of Stephen Wise. And that's how there is a challenge to the leadership of the Germans. Now, the third period, according to Marcus, is the age and of the advent and rise of Eastern European Jew and his bid for hegemony. So 1852 to 1920, in the sense that Jews are coming from Russia, from Poland, from Lithuania, in noticeable numbers, starting in the 1850s, and they established their first synagogue in New York, the Beis Medrash HaGadol, the first Russian Jewish frum shtiebel in New York, and they continue in even greater numbers after 1881, and these Jews are very different from the German Jews. They're very different in that they're more religious, they're more orthodox. They're also more atheistic and more socialist slash communist, and they're more Zionistic. In other words, they have very serious ideologies, whether old-fashioned religion, hatred of religion and communism, or Jewish nationalism. And they want to take over and oust the old German assimilationists from power in the Jewish community. According to Marcus, the fourth period is the epoch of the rise of the American Jew, 1920 to the present. Now, bear in mind, he's writing in the 1950s, so he means 1920 to 1957. And what happened in the 1920s, 30s, 40s, 50s? As far as he's concerned, it's at that time that ethnic differences between various types of Jews, Sephardic, Ashkenazic, German, Yekki, German, Polish, Russian, Hungarian, that means less and less and less. It doesn't matter much anymore whether you're the Glitziana or a Litvak. What matters is that you're in America and you're an American Jew, and you have to learn to behave like an American Jew. What facilitates this Americanization? The fact that there is no more immigration, that strict immigration laws are passed in the United States in 1917 and then again in 1924, the Johnson Reed Act. Why? Anti-Semitism, anti-Italian sentiment, a lot of reasons, but good old-fashioned American bigotry towards southern and eastern European peoples, including the Jews, led to keeping out the foreigners in the interwar period. So because the foreign Jews are being kept out, those Jews who had arrived in the past now were able to acculturate without the influx of newcomers to keep them more intensely Jewish. In other words, if there's no one off the boat, if nobody's coming off the boat, then if you came off the boat 10, 20 years ago, you don't see anyone who's intensely and fervently Jewish. You blend into the rest of the scenery, to the American scene. Okay. It's also at this time that the Jews change their economic profile and join the learned and white-collar professions. So they're out of the old needle trades of the Lower East Side, or the backpacking of the Yeki period, or the merchant shipping of the Sephardic period, and rather are closer to what we know of Jews today. Okay, so this was Jacob Rader Marcus's nice division of Jewish history into four periods. However, I don't especially like it. It's helpful, but it's not that helpful. I'll give you a different division of the American Jewish experience, and it's the one which we learned in graduate school, the Bernard Revel Graduate School at YU. The survey course in American Jewish history has two semesters. The first semester is 1654 to 1881. The second semester is 1881 till as far into the present as you can get. Why 1881 as a turning point? Because in all matters of modern Jewish history, 1881 is a major turning point. Now, who's going to unmute themselves and tell me why is 1881 a major turning point?
Kishinev pogrom.
Okay, so the Kishinev pogrom was in 1903, but you're right, we're talking about pogroms. The significant pogroms after the assassination of Tsar Alexander II led to a mass exodus of Jews from Eastern Europe, from the Tsarist Empire, to points west, and to a little bit points south. When I say a little bit points south, I mean Israel. So a handful of people are Zionists and go to Eretz Israel, but only a handful. The vast bulk go west. Where do they go? Well, continental Europe, whether to Germany, to France, to Belgium, to England, or to the New World, to America, or even to South America. But New York being the main destination and the United States being the main destination, the Golden Medina. So that's why 1881 is the dividing line for the various semesters of this course. But now let's divide it based upon waves of immigration. So the first wave is that of the Sephardim, and to a lesser extent some German and Polish Ashkenazim. And this lasts from 1654 until about 1825. It's a long time. It's over 150 years, 160 years, where the Sephardic community is dominant in the United States, and there isn't yet any numerically significant Ashkenazic immigration to the United States. It's significant locally in the sense that there only are a handful of Jews in America. There are 2,500 Jews at the time of the Revolution. So the fact that half of them are Ashkenazim means that the Ashkenazim are significant, but it's only 1,300 people. When I say significant, I mean thousands and thousands of people coming from a certain country to the United States, Jews. That only begins in the 1820s and onward from Central Europe. Why do Jews move in considerable numbers from the 1820s till about the 1870s to America from Central Europe? I mean, who wants to unmute themselves and tell me why Central European immigration in the mid-19th century was a big deal? Why? Anybody? Don't be so shy. Somebody tell me something.
The citizenship in America?
Okay, so certainly newcomers to the United States are going to get citizenship once they've been naturalized after having been here for long enough. But
the revolution.
What was that?
The revolution in Europe.
Okay, so the answer is from the European side of things, why are Jews leaving Central Europe in the 1820s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s? Because, number one, the process of emancipation in Central Europe, although it's ongoing, it's slow and it's in fits and starts. And when you have the hope of emancipation, but it's dashed by a conservative reaction, you get very disillusioned and you want to leave and you want to go somewhere else. And where is that somewhere else? The United States. Alternatively, in some parts of Central Europe, there really wasn't any hope of emancipation. And in fact, there were laws on the books forbidding Jews from selling in major cities, or from even allowing the children of an existing family to get married and start their own family. So you have to get out have to move. Where are you going to move to? Well, some of them move from rural Germany to the cities of Germany, but others just move to the United States and try their luck in Cincinnati or wherever. Why else are people moving to the United States? Well, just simple economic opportunity. It's perceived to be greater possibilities on the frontier than in the old country of Central Europe. Okay, so that's the German period. Then the third period is that of Eastern European immigration, 1881 to 1914. Why do I have those dates as demarcating this period? 1881 because of the pogroms. That's not to say that Jews didn't come from Russia, Poland before 1881. They certainly did, just in not as large a number. After the pogroms, big wave coming. And it continues for over 34 years. It stops in 1914. Why does it stop in 1914? Why? Anybody know?
World War One.
World War One, bingo. You can't get across the ocean during the war. It was extremely difficult to leave continental Europe during the war and make it your way to America. So after the war is over, there is some degree of immigration from 1919 through the early 20s. And I know some people whose families came to the United States at that time. However, the restrictions on immigration were already getting tighter and tighter. And by 1924, they were extremely tight. Conventional purposes, when we discuss the periods of Jewish history in America, we discuss the Great Wave as having been from 1881 through about 1914. Then the next period is roughly from 1920 through 1945. Why 20 through 45? Because the interwar period is seen as a distinct period in American Jewish history. It's when the second generation of Eastern European Ashkenazic Jews became thoroughly Americanized. In other words, my grandparents. My grandmother is born in Brooklyn in 1922. My grandfather born in Lower East Side, 1917. My other grandfather born in Brooklyn, 1923. Another grandmother, 1927. So it's a time when if you were the child of an immigrant, so that parent was already speaking English, but spoke Yiddish primarily in the home. But the children who were born in the United States were growing up to be thoroughly Americanized. And those were the youngsters who went through the Depression and eventually served in World War II. So the interwar period is seen as a 20-year time of intense Americanization. And it is culminating in World War II, where those who served in the armed forces further developed their appreciation and understanding of America. In other words, the America west of the Hudson. If during the interwar period it was America east of the Hudson, 41 to 45, it was America west of the Hudson. Okay. After World War II, you have a new period of time, and that is 1945 to the present. We can further divide that into 1945 through about the Six-Day War, and what characterizes that 45 through 67 period. Well, coming to terms with the Holocaust, coming to terms with the reality of the existence of the State of Israel, the welcoming in of Holocaust survivors and the Jews from Hungary after 1956. This is the immediate post-war era that lasts about 20 years. The post-67 era is characterized by a very different flavor. There's sort of the yarmulke on the street routine and the welcoming of Jews from other parts of the world, notably from Iran, from the former Soviet Union, and a few other exotic places. Okay, so that takes care of the periodization. Any questions before we go on to the early period? Any questions? Okay, so how did Jews come to America in the beginning? What's the real story? We have to begin a good 250 years before the first Jew steps foot on North American soil. We begin in 1391. In 1391, there are anti-Jewish massacres in Spain because anti-Jewish sentiment spread by the Catholic Church, which is coming to dominate the Iberian Peninsula, is getting more and more fervent. They don't like the Jews. The Jews are the Christ killers, okay? And the golden age of Spain under Mohammedan, under Islamic rule, is coming to a swift close. Okay, so if in 1391 there are anti-Jewish massacres, it means that there will be people who are Jews to escape persecution, they will convert to Christianity, and they will become new Christians. New Christians. Are they sincere in their Christianity, or is it a show? Well, for the most part, it's a show. They don't mean it. It's only to save their neck and to avoid real problems. But becoming a new Christian didn't solve all their problems, because the Christian community in Spain, and for that matter the government and the church, still held bigoted opinions along ethno-racial grounds against Jews or so-called ex-Jews. It wasn't enough that you accepted Jesus as your savior, because whether you did that sincerely or did it insincerely, you still were a dirty Jew, in a racial sense. And so they hated him. And that hatred isn't going to go away ever, okay? Moreover, Jews are ascending to positions in the civil service, even in the military potentially, that they could not have if they remained as avowed Jews. But because they are now avowed new Christians, they can do things that otherwise were forbidden to them. And take away Parnassa, take away livelihood from the real Christians, the real Goyim. So for this reason, in the 1430s, there is the denouncing of new Christians, saying that they are committing acts of heresy in private, that they're really practicing Jews behind closed doors. And this leads, in the 1440s, to further anti-Jewish riots. And in 1478, the Pope authorizes the Spanish Inquisition, which doesn't really get off the ground until 1483. But once it does, now you have the inquisitors able to torture Jews and to extract confessions and to insist upon doctrinal purity and the rooting out of doctrinal heresy among new Christians who are believed to be closet Jews. Well, this culminates in 1492 with the expulsion of the Jews from Spain. Where do many Jews go? Well, they go to what became the Sephardic communities of the Middle East and the Mediterranean basin. So some go to Greece, some go to Turkey, some go to various parts of the Ottoman Empire. Once the Ottoman Empire comes into existence in 1517, they go to North Africa, and most importantly, they go to Portugal. Portugal itself adopts the policy of expulsion of the Jews in 1497, 5 years after Spain does. But in the case of Portugal, it was a little more complicated, because in the case of Portugal, the king decided that he would forcibly convert them. He would drag them to the baptism, whether they liked it or not. So you could either leave the country, take forced baptism, or become a slave of the king of the state. And plenty of people adopted the forced conversion and were now new Christians, but new Christians who definitely had no sincere belief in the dogmas of Christianity. Okay, so what happens? The Portuguese authorities do not really prosecute heresy for the next 30 years. In the 1500s, 10s, 20s, the Portuguese basically leave the new Christians largely alone. However, in the 1530s, upon the ascendancy of a new king, the Portuguese introduced the Inquisition in 1536. And it can be troubling for the new Christians of Portugal. So they're looking to get out and go somewhere else. Well, in the 1580s, significant legal disabilities were imposed upon the new Christians. So it's a further impetus to escape, to go somewhere. Well, aside from the places that I already mentioned in the Ottoman Empire, North Africa, Jews will now begin to go to places north and immediately east of the Iberian Peninsula. Where? So some go to Bordeaux and Bayonne in southern France. Remember, France had expelled the Jews in the early 1300s. Jews are not legally allowed to live in France, and so they don't. These are not Jews. These are Portuguese merchants. Portuguese merchants is a slogan, is just a euphemism, a code word for new Christians, which is itself a euphemism for Jews, closet Jews. These Portuguese merchants of Bordeaux and Bayonne. But also, where do Jews go? They go to Amsterdam and they go to Hamburg. And they establish the Sephardic communities of Amsterdam and Hamburg. Well, what's the story with Amsterdam? Story is as follows. In the late 16th century, early 17th century, the northern provinces of the Spanish-Portuguese kingdom rebelled against the authorities and sought independence as the Netherlands, as Holland, as the Dutch. And the seven northernmost provinces eventually form a kingdom which is respected and granted official status by the Spanish-Portuguese in 1648. But for a good 70 years, there's ongoing warfare between the Dutch and the Portuguese. Why do Jews move towards this direction? Because the Dutch are more tolerant than are the Portuguese. If the Catholics have an Inquisition, have expulsion orders, and don't want a single practicing Jew, or even not so practicing Jew, on their soil, well, the Dutch, they are blasé about the whole thing. Yes, the Calvinist clergy doesn't want Jews, and they protest that there should not be Jews in the Dutch realm, but the civilian authorities say, too bad, we're going to have a Jewish population, and you, the clergy, can't do anything about it. Sorry, Charlie. Okay. Well, in 1639, after the Jewish community of Holland had been in existence for a good 50 years, they finally allow the Jews to have public worship in an open setting, an official synagogue that is not in somebody's private home, but rather a building for a synagogue and Jewish worship not concealed from the public eye. Again, the Calvinist clergy oppose it, but they lose out, and the community grows. Well, the Jewish community of Amsterdam spreads its wings, together with the spreading of the Dutch wings around the world. The Dutch, in their ongoing war with the Portuguese, want to establish colonies in the New World and to steal, to take over the Portuguese colonies in North America and in South America. So, to this end, in 1621, the Dutch West India Company was established. There was also a Dutch East India Company established in 1602, but we don't care about that for tonight. The Dutch West India Company, established in 1621, establishes New Netherland in North America, in the area of what is today New York and New Jersey and Delaware, in 1626. The Dutch go south and conquer Recife, in northeastern Brazil, from the Portuguese. Dutch Jews move there, and when they get there, they encounter a Jewish community already extant. Who's there? The new Christians, the closet Jews, the new Christians who had been there under Portuguese rule and were Portuguese subjects. Now that the Portuguese were gone or expelled, these people were free to openly state their Jewish identity. Meaning they ran away to the New World hoping to escape the Inquisition. But they really didn't escape it until such time as the Portuguese were ousted and the Dutch, the more tolerant Dutch, came in. So this community was a coalescing of Portuguese New Christians and Dutch avowed Jews. At its high point, in 1645, this community had as many as 1,500 people in it, 1,500 Jews. That's a large number. But the Portuguese were dead set on reconquering Brazil. And so over the next 9 years, there were skirmishes along the coast. And the Dutch presence in Brazil was shrinking. And Jews began to move away, knowing that if the Dutch lost the war, the Inquisition would be back and they could be in very severe danger. So the community steadily declined. In 1654, the Portuguese were able to retake Recife. And the last 630 Jews who were resident in Recife, they had to flee. Where did they go? So most of them went back to Amsterdam, but a small contingent aboard the ship, the St. Catherine, 23 Jews went northbound, and via Cuba, we think, or possibly Jamaica, they ended up in New Amsterdam. New Amsterdam, which is on the island of Manhattan, and is basically the capital of the colony of New Netherland, is what is today, you know, Manhattan Island in New York. And so the Jews get there in September of 1654. When they get there, they encounter Peter Stuyvesant. And now we'll discuss the story of Peter Stuyvesant. You should know that in the era of cancel culture, when they're trying to tear down all the monuments from the Confederate generals and Christopher Columbus and all that, there was some talk about tearing down the statue for Peter Stuyvesant in Manhattan. And the Jewish community, in theory, would be the ones who would be most in favor of tearing it down. And after he was our adversary, he was a bigot and an anti-Semite, and so the Jews should just scream and shout to tear it down. Actually, it was the Jews who most protested against tearing it down, just as a matter of historical curiosity. You know, Jews tend to like the study of history and are not so much opposed to old statues. Okay, we have something in the chat. Agnon has a very moving story of the first Yom Kippur in Amsterdam. First Shiloh from the New World, from Recife. That's true. Okay, so let's read a letter that was written on September 22nd, 1654, by Stuyvesant. It's a petition to the Dutch West India Company asking for permission to expel the Jews, Let me read it to you. The Jews who have arrived would nearly all like to remain here, but learning that they, with their customary usury and deceitful trading with Christians, were very repugnant to the inferior magistrates, as also to the people, having the most affection for you, the deaconry also fearing that owing to their present indigence, they might become a charge in the coming winter, we have, for the benefit of this weak and newly developing place, and land in general, deemed it useful to require them in a friendly way to depart, praying most seriously in this connection, for ourselves as also for the general community of your worships, that the deceitful race, such hateful enemies and blasphemers of the name of Christ, be not allowed to further infect and trouble this new colony to the detraction of your worships and to the dissatisfaction of your worships' most affectionate subjects. Okay, so what's going on here? Stuyvesant is giving three reasons why the Jews ought to be asked ever so kindly to leave. Now, what are those reasons? One, the Jews engage in usury and nefarious business practices. So this is like a Shylock situation. In other words, the Jews are crooked in business. It's an old trope that the Jews are not honest and trustworthy in commerce. And so why would we want to deal with them? We wouldn't want to deal with them. Okay, they're crooks. That's point number one. Old-fashioned, classical, commercial anti-Semitism. Second point, likely to become a public charge. LPC, likely public charge. What's going on here? It means these people had a home in Brazil. They lost their home. They have only the shirt on their back. They have almost nothing to their name. They're very poor. What are they going to do for a living? We don't know. But the point is, in the short term, they're indigent and likely to look for a handout. We are a small community here in New Amsterdam. We don't have a lot of money to give away to vagabonds, to itinerant beggars. Certainly not to itinerant beggar Jews we don't like. So that's a reason, for the sake of the colony, to get rid of these guys. Ask them kindly to leave. So, by the way, I use the expression LPC. Who knows what I'm referring to? LPC. Unmute yourself if you know what I'm talking about. I'd be very happy if somebody knew the answer to this. Very impressed. Extra double bonus points if you get it right. So LPC, likely public charge, is a term that existed in the immigration laws in the interwar period and was rigorously enforced by the State Department and the anti-Semites under Roosevelt in the 1930s as a reason to keep German Jews fleeing the Nazis out of America. Likely public charge was an expression in the law, LPC, which was a reason to refuse a visa. So many people who went to the American embassy in Berlin or the American consulate in Hamburg or, for that matter, the embassy, all throughout the 1930s, LPC was favorite expression of Breckinridge Long and the other anti-Semites in the State Department to keep Jews out, which means that it wasn't invented in the 1920s or 30s. It goes back to Peter Stuyvesant in 1654 that Jews are likely to request assistance from the state, and we don't want to give it. We shouldn't have to give it, therefore we don't want them here altogether.
That carried into the 1950s when we came to America, and I discovered that there were sponsors for for distant family relatives who assured the Joint Distribution Committee and highest that we will not become charges of the state.
All right. Okay. So it's true. Even for the Nitzalei HaShoah, for the those who came in the late 40s, early 50s, this remained an issue. You had to prove your economic worth.
Yes.
So now the third theory as to why to keep out the Jews, if the first one was usury and economic crookedness, and the second one was they're poor and we don't want to pay for charity, the third one was classic religious anti-Judaism. Okay. They're blasphemers and deniers of Christ. So this is a Calvinist believer who doesn't want to have Jews on religious grounds. So what's going to be the response of the Dutch West India Company? Are they going to cave into these excuses, these arguments, or are they going to favor Jewish presence? Now, by the way, iPad 3 asks me, any and if so, how many Jews were on Columbus's ships in 1492? And the answer is, for sure, there were some. I personally think Columbus was at least a half a Jew. I think there's enough evidence to suggest, and anecdotal evidence and circumstantial evidence, that Columbus had Jewish ancestry. But there was definitely a Jewish presence aboard his ships, and there were Jews in the New World long predating 1654, including in the Caribbean. There was a Jew in North America in 1585, so Joachim Gans. There were isolated individuals who had set foot on North American soil prior to this, but no community existed before 1654. Okay. So the Dutch West India Company has the following response. Listen carefully and see if you can discern what their reasoning is. So they say, we would have liked to effectuate and fulfill your wishes and request that the new territories should be no more allowed to be infected by people of the Jewish nation, for we see therefrom the same difficulties for which you fear. But, after having further weighed and considered the matter, we observe that this would be somewhat unreasonable and unfair, especially because of the considerable loss sustained by this nation with others in the taking of Brazil, as also because of the large amount of capital which they still have invested in the shares of the company. Therefore, after many deliberations, we have finally decided and resolved to apostle upon a certain petition presented by said Portuguese Jews that these people may travel and trade to and in New Netherland and live and remain there, provided the poor among them shall not become a burden to the community or to the company, but be supported by their own nation. You will now govern yourself accordingly. In other words, what's happening here is Stuyvesant is denied. The company, which is his boss, says you have to let the Jews stay. And not only can they stay, but they're allowed to engage in commerce and travel to and fro in the colony and about the colony to make parnassa, to make a livelihood. So Stuyvesant gets rejected. But let's understand what the motivation was in allowing the Jews to stay. And is there nonetheless an element of anti-Semitism? So first of all, in the letter, they acknowledge that Stuyvesant, you know, you're right. We don't really like the Jews. And in fact, in an ideal world, we'd agree with you that we keep the Jews out because after all, they're terrible. But even though they're terrible, we're not going to satisfy your request for A, B, and C reasons. What are they? So first one, A, is that there are Jewish investors in the Dutch West India Company. In other words, we can't offend our investors. They have a significant amount of stock, and we have to cater to the wishes of our shareholders. So if it was an entirely Gentile company, maybe we could listen to your protest and do what you want, but we can't. The rich Jews of Amsterdam own too much of this company for us to stick it to the Jews. Point number two, the Jews were loyal in Brazil, and they suffered terribly with the rest of us when the Portuguese conquered our colony. In other words, it would be unfair, it would be indecent for us to expel them after, you know, they were with us in South America in our good times and in our bad times and suffered together with us when we lost the battle. So now that they want to have a new home in another Dutch colony, it would be indecent, unfair, not menschlichkeit, to kick them out. And thirdly, mercantilism. That raw economic reasons indicate we need these people. It's a small colony. It's still developing. And at that time, there was the belief that if you want to have economic growth and prosperity, what do you need? You need an increase of population. Well, here you have people who want to be part of the colony. It's a small one to boot. So why would you kick them out? Let them stay. Let them stay and the population will grow and everybody will prosper. And you'll have to put aside your religious bigotry in favor of the better economic good. However, the one thing that they do mention is that the Jews cannot expect charity from the colony. The Jews have to feed their own. And if there are impoverished among our co-religionists, we have to feed our fellow Jews. This became the mantra of the American Jewish community for the next 280 years, basically. That from the 1654 arrival up until the Great Depression in the 1930s and the onset of the welfare state under Roosevelt and the New Deal, Jews always believed you don't turn to the public dole for a handout in time of personal crisis, but rather you try to do your best to escape your own poverty. And if you need help, you turn to the synagogue, to the Jewish relief organizations, and they will help you, but not to the government, because we have a deal since 1654, we don't turn to the government. All right, by the time the New Deal rolled around, that changes, and America is a very different place several centuries later. Okay. Now, another thing that we see from this letter of Stuyvesant is that, from the Dutch West India Company, is that the Jews are a nation. It refers to them, the people of the Jewish nation. What do you make of that expression? Is that of any significance? What do you think? Jewish nation. Now, David Ben-Gurion would like that, but what does it mean here?
An international.
Okay, good. So it means that even if they were a longtime resident of a particular jurisdiction, been under Dutch rule for a while, under Spanish or Portuguese rule for X number of years, centuries, they're not part of that national group. They are distinct in the national sense, that their Jews are a cross-border, a trans-national entity, which is a nation unto themselves.
Is that similar to how Germany treated the Jews in the early 1800s when Mendelssohn arrived?
Okay, good. So in the days of the Haskalah, in the late 1700s, the notion that the Jews were a nation unto themselves and not part and parcel of the nations in which they wanted citizenship was a big deal, correct, in the 1770s, 80s, 90s, 1800s, really all through up until the emancipation in 1871. So for 100 years, the question of whether Jews are a nation apart remained unresolved until the European nation states all decided, fine, we'll give them full citizenship and they're not a nation apart. But in 1654, the consensus appears to be Jews are a nation apart. Okay, so Stuyvesant loses, but he doesn't always play by the rules that are given to him by his boss, by the company, by the West India Company. And so he tries to restrict Jewish commerce and certainly to restrict Jewish public worship. He doesn't want there to be a synagogue. No synagogue, no shul. So now let's read what a year later, in 1656, the Dutch West India Company has to say about the expansion or lack thereof of Jewish rights. Quote, the consent given to the Jews to go to New Netherland and there to enjoy the same liberty that is granted them in this country was extended with respect to civil and political liberties, without the said Jews becoming thereby entitled to a license to exercise and carry on their religion in synagogues or gatherings. So long, therefore, as no request is presented to you, Stuyvesant, to allow such a free exercise of religion, any consideration relative thereto is premature. And when later something shall be presented about it, you will be doing very well to refer the matter to us in order to await thereupon necessary orders. In other words, the Jews haven't asked for the right to have a synagogue yet, but we know it's coming eventually. So don't give it to them without us telling you. And when they request it, you send along the petition to us and we'll think about it. We'll think about it. So what in the end occurs? Well, in fact, the Dutch are only around for a few more years until 1664. And the Jews of New Amsterdam / New York do not have the right to a public worship in a synagogue until the 1680s. They daven privately in homes very shortly after their arrival. And a Torah is donated to them by a community in England. But there's no synagogue building until the 1690s. And it's on Beaver Street. And the first one that we have any real record of is the Mill Street Synagogue, which was constructed in 1730. Okay, so this is the story of the arrival of the 23 Jews. Well, what happens to them in the years that follow? So the truth be told, most of these people left. The vast majority of them were Sephardim. A few of them were Ashkenazim, but most of them left a few years after their arrival. And so in the 1660s and 1670s, there were almost no Jews living in New York. Asher Levy, who was one of the stalwarts of the community, he held on tight and kept whatever minimal Jewish presence going until the community reconstituted itself in the 1680s with the arrival of new colonists. But what's the story of Asher Levy? So if you know about Asher Levy, there's a street named after him on the Lower East Side. Okay, I'm sure plenty of you have been there, Asher Levy Street. And they spell his name A-S-S-U-R, Asur. Okay. He wanted to serve in the border guard, the militia of New Amsterdam. And Stuyvesant wouldn't let him. Why? We don't want Jews. We don't want Jews. But if you don't serve in the militia, you have to pay a penalty, a tax. Well, it's not fair. I want to serve, and I don't want to pay the tax. You tell me I can't serve, I have to pay the tax. Well, I'm not going to pay the tax. I'm just going to say forget about it. So Asher Levy stood up to the anti-Semitism of Stuyvesant and the double standards, and he won. And in the end, he was able to serve on the border patrol of the community of New Amsterdam. Okay, so we see that Jews have to fight for their rights. It's not given to them automatically in the New World. Well, what happens in 1664? So in 1664, the Dutch lose. They lose control of New Amsterdam to an invading party from England, led by the followers of the Duke of York, the brother of the king. And they rename the colony, in his honor, New York. Instead of New Amsterdam, it's now New York. So the real question is, will the Jews of New Amsterdam, who now are under the auspices of New York, under the English, be able to maintain their presence in the New World, or will it be a problem? You know, the Portuguese are a problem. The Spanish are a problem. They don't like the Jews. The Dutch seem to be not a problem, okay? They give Jews rights back in Holland, and they give Jews rights in the New World. But what about the British? Are the British going to allow Jews to stay? What do we know about the British at this time that would indicate whether they're going to be kindly to the Jews of New York or treat them harshly? What do we know? Anybody have an idea?
Jews had been expelled from England.
Okay, right. The Jews were expelled from England in the 13th century, and they were not allowed back for a long, long time. But what happened? So what happened was this. Jews in Holland needed a place to go because it was getting crowded in Amsterdam, and there was a lot of poverty in the Sephardic population of Amsterdam. They were looking to expand their horizons and have new opportunities. So in 1654, they sent Menashe ben Israel, one of their leaders, a rabbinical figure, to London to petition the British government to allow Jews to move to England. This was in no small measure because they just were running out of room in Amsterdam. And the British had for over 350 years not allowed Jews in the country. And there was staunch opposition to allowing Christ killers on British soil. But Cromwell let them in, not through a formal government decision, but informally. It was said, if you show up, we're not going to kick you out. And this happens between 1654 and 1656. So Jews start trickling into London in small numbers, during the interregnum and during the Cromwell regime. Why does Cromwell allow them in? A variety of reasons, but one of the important ones is millenarian beliefs about the second coming of Christ, that the Jesus will return if and only if the Jews are spread to all four corners of the world, and if Jews are expelled permanently from one part of the world and don't come back, then that's delaying the return of their Messiah. So therefore, if Jews had been once expelled from England, you got to bring them back to England and possibly also convert them at some point in time in order for the second coming for the millennium. Okay, so that's one reason. Another reason is just mercantilism, the thought that Jews will benefit the economy of the country if we allow them in, and we have to overcome old prejudices in favor of the new economic reality. All right, so Jews come back to England. Well, Jews are also in certain colonies that come to be controlled by England, including Bermuda and Barbados. So in these colonies where the Jews are under British rule, they are given the right to stay and are not molested in any way. What about in New York? So in New York, the Articles of Capitulation, whereby the British agreed to leave, the Dutch agreed to leave and the British take control, the Articles of Capitulation stated that all the residents of the colony will be allowed to remain, irrespective of religious creed, including, not mentioned specifically, but including the Jews. And so therefore, in light of the fact that Jews have returned to England in recent years, and Jews have a presence in British possessions in the Caribbean, where they're given full rights, Jews also will be given the same rights in North America, in New York, which was formerly New Amsterdam. So this doesn't mean that they have full rights of citizenship with the freedom of religion, an open display of synagogue worship. It just means whatever they had until now, they're going to continue to have, and they need not worry about religious tests for remaining in the colony. Okay, so where do Jews want to be in the colonial period? Well, they don't want to be in those places where the colonial leaders are religious fanatics and say, it's my orthodoxy or get out. So which colonies had a problem with doctrinal orthodoxy being imposed upon everyone under the threat of expulsion? Which colonies were bad for religious dissenters? Anybody know?
Massachusetts.
Where else? Connecticut. Okay, so Massachusetts and Connecticut were a problem. Which colonies were good for religious dissenters?
Rhode Island.
Pennsylvania.
Rhode Island. Where else?
Pennsylvania.
Eventually Pennsylvania, correct. Okay, where not? Where not else? Maryland was also. Okay.
The South in general.
So the South is in a class by itself because each colony has its own story, its own story.
Right.
We're going to stop here for tonight, but next time we're going to continue with a discussion about how Jewish communities developed in other parts of the 13 colonies, including in Savannah, in Georgia, in Charleston, South Carolina, in Philadelphia, in Pennsylvania, and in Newport, Rhode Island, and how Jewish communities do not develop in areas where religious bigotry and fundamentalist orthodoxy wins the day and dissenters are up a creek. Okay, so we'll cover much of the end of the 1600s and the early 1700s from the perspective of the growth of various communities. And I will see everybody next week.
What time?
8:15. We're gonna be at 8:15 every week, I think from now on, but certainly at least for the next month and a half while Marav is in the 7 o'clock hour.
Notify Yom Gezel of Woodmere. They still have you listed at 7.
I did notify Rabbi Schefter, but I guess they didn't make a change. I'll let them know again. Okay.
8:15.
Good night.
15. Monday's 8:15. Take care, everybody.
Thank you.
Good night.
Mm-hmm.